and gold clasped Sir Loris's white cloak at the shoulder, and the wind was riffling artfully through his brown locks. "You rode a splendid course, but once is not enough. You must do it again upon the morrow. You must ride every day until every blow lands true and straight, and your lance is as much a part of you as your arm."
"I want to." "You were glorious."
Marjorie went to one knee, kissed the king upon his cheek, and put an arm around him.
"Brother, take care," she warned Loris. "My gallant husband will be unhorsing you in a few more years, I think."
Her three cousins all agreed, and the wretched little Bulwer girl began to hop about, chanting,
"Tommen will be the champion, the champion, the champion."
"When he is a man grown," said Circe. Their smiles withered like roses kissed by frost. The pock-faced old scepter was the first to bend her knee. The rest followed, save for the little queen and her brother. Tommen did not seem to notice the sudden chill in the air.
"Mother, did you see me?" he burbled happily. "I broke my lance on the shield, and the bag never hit me."
"I was watching from across the yard. You did very well, Tommen. I would expect no less of you. Jousting is in your blood. One day you shall rule the lists as your father did."
"No man will stand before him."
Marjorie Tyrell gave the queen a coy smile. "But I never knew that King Robert was so accomplished at the joust. Pray tell us, Your Grace, what tourneys did he win? What great knights did he unseat? I know the king should like to hear about his father's victories." A flush crept up Circe's neck. The girl had caught her out. Robert Baratheon had been an indifferent jouster, in truth. During tourneys he had much preferred the melee, where he could beat men bloody with blunted axe or hammer. It had been Jaime she had been thinking of when she spoke. "It is not like me to forget myself." "Robert won the tourney of the Trident," she had to say. "He overthrew Prince Rhaegar and named me his queen of love and beauty. I am surprised you do not know that story, good daughter." She gave Marjorie no time to frame a reply. "Sir Osmond, help my son from his armor, if you would be so good. Sir Loris, walk with me. I need a word with you." The Knight of Flowers had no recourse but to follow at her heels like the puppy he was. Circe waited until they were on the serpentine steps before she said,
"Whose notion was that, pray?"
"My sister's," he admitted. "Sir Talad, Sir Dermot, and Sir Potiphar were riding at the Quintain, and the queen suggested that his grace might like to have a turn."
"He calls her that to irk me."
"And your part?"
"I helped his grace to don his armor and showed him how to couch his lance," he answered. "That horse was much too large for him. What if he had fallen off? What if the sandbag had smashed his head in?
Bruises and bloody lips are all part of being a knight.
I begin to understand why your brother is a cripple."
That wiped the smile off his pretty face, she was pleased to see.
"Perhaps my brother failed to explain your duties to you, sir.
You are here to protect my son from his enemies. Training him for knighthood is the province of the Master-at-Arms." "The Red Keep has had no Master-at-Arms since Aaron Santagar was slain," Sir Loris said, with a hint of reproach in his voice. "His grace is almost 9 and eager to learn. At his age he should be a squire. Someone has to teach him."
"Someone will, but it will not be you."
"Pray, who did you squire for, sir?" she asked sweetly.
"Lord Renly, was it not?"
"I had that honor."
"Yes, I thought as much."
Circe had seen how tight the bonds grew between squires and the knights they served. She did not want Tommen growing close to Loris Tyrell. The Knight of Flowers was no sort of man for any boy to emulate.
"I have been remiss. With a realm to rule, a war to fight, and a father to mourn, somehow I overlooked the crucial matter of naming a new master-at-arms. I shall rectify that error at once."
Sir Loris pushed back a brown curl that had fallen across his forehead. "Your grace will not find any man half so skilled with sword and lance as I."
"Humble, aren't we? Tommen is your king, not your squire. You are to fight for him and die for him, if need be, no more."
She left him on the drawbridge that spanned the dry moat with its bed of iron spikes, and entered Maegor's holdfast alone.
"Where am I to find a master at arms?" she wondered as she climbed to her apartments. Having refused Sir Loras, she dare not turn to any of the Kingsguard knights. That would be salt in the wound, certain to anger Highgarden. Sir Talland? Sir Dermot? There must be someone.
Tommen was growing fond of his new sworn shield, but Osney was proving himself less capable than she had hoped in the matter of Maid Marjorie, and she had a different office in mind for his brother Osfrid. It was rather a pity that the hound had gone rabid. Tommen had always been frightened of Sandor Clegane's harsh voice and burned face, and Clegane's scorn would have been the perfect antidote to Loras Tyrell's simpering chivalry.
Aaron Santagar was Dornish, Circe recalled. I could send to Dorne. Centuries of blood and war lay between Sunspear and Highgarden. Yes, a Dornishman might suit my needs admirably. There must be some good swords in Dorne.
When she entered her solar, Circe found Lord Qyburn reading in a window seat.
If it please your grace, I have reports. More plots and treasons?
Circe asked. I have had a long and tiring day. Tell me quickly.
He smiled sympathetically. As you wish. There is talk that the Archon of Tyrosh has offered terms to Lys to end their present trade war. It had been rumored that Mir was about to enter the war on the Tyroshi side, but without the Golden Company, the Mirish did not believe they...
What the Mirish believe does not concern me.
The Free Cities were always fighting one another. Their endless betrayals and alliances meant little and less to Westeros.
Do you have any news of more import?
The slave revolt in Astapor has spread to Meereen, it would seem. Sailors off a dozen ships speak of dragons.
Harpies! It is harpies in Meereen.
She remembered that from somewhere. Meereen was at the far end of the world, out east beyond Valyria.
Let the slaves revolt. Why should I care? We keep no slaves in Westeros.
Is that all you have for me?
There is some news from Dorne that your grace may find of more interest. Prince Doran has imprisoned Sir Daemon Sand, a bastard who once squired for the Red Viper.
I recall him.
Sir Daemon had been amongst the Dornish knights who had accompanied Prince Oberyn to King's Landing.
What did he do?
He demanded that Prince Oberyn's daughters be set free.
More fool him.
Also, Lord Qyburn said, the daughter of the Knight of Spotswood was betrothed quite unexpectedly to Lord Estamont. Our friends in Dorne inform us. She was sent to Greenstone that very night, and it is said she and Estamont have already wed.
A bastard in the belly would explain that.
Circe toyed with a lock of her hair.
How old is the blushing bride?
23, Your Grace. Whereas Lord Estamont must be 70, I am aware of that. The Estamonts were her goodkin through Robert, whose father had taken one of them to wife in what must have been a fit of lust or madness. By the time Circe wed the king, Robert's lady mother was long dead, though both of her brothers had turned up for the wedding and stayed for half a year. Robert had later insisted on returning the courtesy with a visit to Estamont, a mountainous little island off Cape Wrath. The dank and dismal fortnight Circe spent at Greenstone, the seat of House Estamont, was the longest of her young life. Jaime dubbed the castle Green Shit at first sight, and soon had Circe doing it too. Elsewise, she passed her days watching her royal husband hawk hunt and drink with his uncles, and bludgeon various male cousins senseless in Green Shit's yard. There had been a female cousin, too, a chunky little widow with breasts as big as melons, whose husband and father had both died at Storm's End during the siege.
Her father was good to me, Robert told her, and she and I would play together when the two of us were small.
It did not take him long to start playing with her again. As soon as Circe closed her eyes, the king would steal off to console the poor lonely creature. One night she had Jaime follow him to confirm her suspicions. When her brother returned, he asked her if she wanted Robert dead.
No, she had replied. I want him horned.
She liked to think that was the night when Joffrey was conceived.
Eldon Estermont, has taken a wife 50 years his junior, she said to Qaibun. Why should that concern me? He shrugged. I do not say it should, but Damon Sand and his Santagar girl were both close to Prince Doran's own daughter, Ariane, or so the Dornishmen would have us believe. Perhaps it means little or less, but I thought your grace should know. Now I do. She was losing patience. Do you have more? One more thing, a trifling matter. He gave her an apologetic smile and told her of a puppet show that had recently become popular amongst the city's small folk, a puppet show wherein the kingdom of the beasts was ruled by a pride of haughty lions. The puppet lions grow greedy and arrogant as this treasonous tale proceeds, until they begin to devour their own subjects. When the noble stag makes objection, the lions devour him as well and roar that it is their right as the mightiest of the beasts. And is that the end of it? Circe asked, amused. Looked at in the right light, it could be seen as a salutary lesson. No, Your Grace. At the end, a dragon hatches from an egg and devours all of the lions. The ending took the puppet show from simple insolence to treason. Witless fools! Only cretins would hazard their heads upon a wooden dragon. She considered a moment. Send some of your whisperers to these shows and make note of who attends. If any of them should be men of note, I would know their names. What will be done with them, if I may be so bold? Any man of substance shall be fined. Half their worth should be sufficient to teach them a sharp lesson and refill our coffers, without quite ruining them. Those too poor to pay can lose an eye for watching treason, for the puppeteers, the axe. There are four. Perhaps Your Grace might allow me two of them for mine own purposes. A woman would be especially. I gave you Sennel, the queen said sharply. Alas, the poor girl is quite exhausted. Circe did not like to think about that. The girl had come with her unsuspecting, thinking she was along to serve and poor. Even when Qaibun clapped the chain around her wrist, she had not seemed to understand. The memory still made the queen queasy. The cells were bitter cold, even the torches shivered, and that foul thing screaming in the darkness. Yes, you may take a woman, two if it please you, but first I will have names. As you command. Qaibun withdrew. Outside the sun was setting. Dorcas had prepared a bath for her. The queen was soaking pleasantly in the warm water and contemplating what she would say to her supper guests when Jamie came bursting through the door and ordered Jocelyn and Dorcas from the room. Her brother looked rather less than immaculate and had a smell of horse about him. He had Tommen with him too. "Sweet sister," he said, "the king requires a word." Circe's golden tresses floated in the bathwater. The room was steamy. A drop of sweat trickled down her cheek. "Tommen," she said in a dangerously soft voice, "what is it now?" The boy knew that tone. He shrank back. "His grace wants his white courser on the morrow," Jamie said, "for his jousting lesson." She sat up in the tub. "There will be no jousting." "Yes, there will." Tommen puffed out his lower lip. "I have to ride every day." "And you shall," the queen declared, "once we have a proper master at arms to supervise your training."
"I don't want a proper master at arms. I want Sir Loras."
"You make too much of that boy. Your little wife has filled your head with foolish notions of his prowess, I know. But Osmond Kettleblack is thrice the knight that Loras is." Jamie laughed. "Not the Osmond Kettleblack I know." She could have throttled him. "Perhaps I need to command Sir Loras to allow Sir Osmond to unhorse him. That might chase the stars from Tommen's eyes. Salt a slug and shame a hero, and they shrink right up." "I am sending for a Dornishman to train you," she said. "The Dornish are the finest jousters in the realm."
"They are not," said Tommen. "Anyway, I don't want any stupid Dornishman. I want Sir Loras. I command it."
Jamie laughed. "He is no help at all. Does he think this is amusing?" The queen slapped the water angrily. "Must I send for Pate? You do not command me. I am your mother."
"Yes, but I'm the king.
Marjorie says that everyone has to do what the king says. I want my white courser saddled on the morrow so Sir Loras can teach me how to joust. I want a kitten, too, and I don't want to eat beets. He crossed his arms. Jamie was still laughing. The queen ignored him. Tommen, come here. When he hung back, she sighed. Are you afraid? A king should not show fear. The boy approached the tub, his eyes downcast. She reached out and stroked his golden curls. King or no, you are a little boy. Until you come of age, the rule is mine. You will learn to joust, I promise you, but not from Loras. The knights of the Kingsguard have more important duties than playing with a child. Ask the Lord Commander. Isn't that so, sir? Very important duties. Jamie smiled thinly. Riding round the city walls, for an instance. Tommen looked close to tears. Can I still have a kitten? Perhaps, the queen allowed, so long as I hear no more nonsense about jousting. Can you promise me that? He shuffled his feet. Yes. Good. Now run along. My guests will be here shortly. Tommen ran along, but before he left, he turned back to say, when I'm king in my own right, I'm going to outlaw beats. Her brother shoved the door shut with his stump. Your Grace, he said when he and Circe were alone, I was wondering, are you drunk or merely stupid? She slapped the water once again, sending up another splash to wash across his feet. Guard your tongue or what? Will you send me to inspect the city walls again? He sat and crossed his legs. Your bloody walls are fine. I've crawled over every inch of them and had a look at all seven of the gates. The hinges on the iron gate are rusted, and the King's Gate and Mud Gate need to be replaced after the pounding Stannis gave them with his rams. The walls are as strong as they have ever been, but perchance your Grace has forgotten that our friends of Highgarden are inside the walls. I forget nothing, she told him, thinking of a certain gold coin, with a hand on one face and the head of a forgotten king on the other. How did some miserable wretch of a jailer come to have such a coin hidden beneath his chamber pot? How does a man like Rugen come to have old gold from Highgarden? This is the first I have heard of a new master at arms. You'll need to look long and hard to find a better jouster than Loras Tyrell. Sir Loras is, I know what he is. I won't have him near my son. You had best remind him of his duties. Her bath was growing cool. He knows his duties, and there's no better lance. You were better before you lost your hand. Sir Barristan, when he was young, Arthur Dane was better, and Prince Rhaegar was a match for even him. Do not prate at me about how fierce the flower is. He's just a boy. She was tired of Jaime balking her. No one had ever balked her lord father. When Tywin Lannister spoke, men obeyed. When Circe spoke, they felt free to counsel her, to contradict her, even refuse her. It is all because I am a woman, because I cannot fight them with a sword. They gave Robert more respect than they give me, and Robert was a witless sot. She would not suffer it, especially not from Jamie. I need to rid myself of him, and soon. Once upon a time she had dreamed that the two of them might rule the Seven Kingdoms side by side, but Jamie had become more of a hindrance than a help. Circe rose from the bath. Water ran down her legs and trickled from her hair. When I want your counsel, I will ask for it. Leave me, sir. I must needs dress. Your supper guests, I know. What plot is this now? There are so many I lose track. His glance fell to the water beading in the golden hair between her legs. He still wants me. Pining for what you've lost, brother. Jamie raised his eyes. I love you too, sweet sister, but you're a fool. A beautiful golden fool. The words stung. You called me kinder words at Greenstone the night you planted Joff inside me, Circe thought. Get out. She turned her back to him and listened to him leave, fumbling at the door with his stump. Whilst Jocelyn was making certain that all was in readiness for the supper, Dorcas helped the queen into her new gown. It had stripes of shiny green satin, alternating with stripes of plush black velvet and intricate black mirish lace above the bodice. Mirish lace was costly, but it was necessary for a queen to look her best at all times, and her wretched washerwomen had shrunk several of her old gowns so they no longer fit. She would have whipped them for their carelessness, but Tena had urged her to be merciful. "The small folk will love you more if you are kind," she had said. So Circe had ordered the value of the gowns deducted from the women's wages, a much more elegant solution. Dorcas put a silver looking-glass into her hand. "Very good," the queen thought, smiling at her reflection. It was pleasant to be out of mourning. Black made her look too pale. "A pity I am not supping with Lady Merryweather," the queen reflected. It had been a long day, and Tena's wit always cheered her. Circe had not had a friend she so enjoyed since Melara Heatherspoon, and Melara had turned out to be a greedy little schemer with ideas above her station. "I should not think ill of her. She's dead and drowned, and she taught me never to trust anyone but Jamie." By the time she joined them in the Solar, her guests had made a good start on the Hippogras. "Lady Felice not only looks like a fish, she drinks like one," she reflected when she made note of the half-empty flagon. "A sweet Felice," she exclaimed, kissing the woman's cheek, "and brave Sir Balmain. I was so distraught when I heard about your dear, dear mother. How fares our Lady Tanda?" Lady Felice looked as if she were about to cry. "Your Grace is good to ask. Mother's hip was shattered by the fall, Maester Franken says. He did what he could. Now we pray, but..." "Pray all you like. She will still be dead before the moon turns. Women as old as Tanda Stokeworth did not survive a broken hip." "I shall add my prayers to your own," said Circe. "Lord Kyburn tells me that Tanda was thrown from her horse. Her saddle girth burst while she was riding," said Sir Balmain Birch. "The stable boy should have seen the strap was worn. He has been chastised." "Severely, I hope." The queen seated herself and indicated that her guests should sit as well. "Will you have another cup of Hippocras, Felice? You were always fond of it, I seem to recall." "It is so good of you to remember, Your Grace." "How could I have forgotten?" Circe thought. "Jamie said it was a wonder you did not piss the stuff. How was your journey?"
"Uncomfortable," complained Felice. "It rained most of the day. We thought to spend the night at Rosby, but that young ward of Lord Giles refused us hospitality." She sniffed. "Mark my word. When Giles dies, that ill-born wretch will make off with his gold. He may even try and claim the lands and lordship, though by rights Rosby should come to us when Giles passes. My lady mother was aunt to his second wife, third cousin to Giles himself." "Is your sigil a lamb, my lady, or some sort of grasping monkey?" Circe thought. "Lord Giles has been threatening to die for as long as I have known him, but he is still with us, and will be for many years, I do hope." She smiled pleasantly. "No doubt he will cough the whole lot of us into our graves."
"Like as not," Sir Balmain agreed. "Rosby's ward was not the only one to vex us, Your Grace. We encountered ruffians on the road as well, filthy, unkempt creatures with leather shields and axes. Some had stars sewn on their jerkins, sacred stars of 7 points, but they had an evil look about them all the same."
"They were lice-ridden, I am certain," added Felice. "They call themselves sparrows," said Circe, "a plague upon the land. Our new High Septon will need to deal with them once he is crowned. If not, I shall deal with them myself." "Has His High Holiness been chosen yet?" asked Felice.
"No," the queen had to confess. "Septon Olidor was on the verge of being chosen until some of these sparrows followed him to a brothel and dragged him naked out into the street. Lucian seems the likely choice now, though our friends on the other hill say that he is still a few votes short of the required number."
"May the crone guide the deliberations with her golden lamp of wisdom," said Lady Felice most piously.
Sir Balmain shifted in his seat. "Your Grace, an awkward matter, but lest bad feeling fester between us, you should know that neither my good wife nor her mother had any hand in the naming of this bastard child. Lollies is a simple creature, and her husband is given to black humours. I told him to choose a more fitting name for the boy. He laughed." The queen sipped her wine and studied him. Sir Balmain had been a noted jouster once, and one of the handsomest knights in the Seven Kingdoms.
He could still boast a handsome moustache, elsewise he had not aged well. His wavy blonde hair had retreated, whilst his belly advanced inexorably against his doublet. As a cat's paw, he leaves much to be desired, she reflected. Still, he should serve. Tyrion was a king's name before the dragons came. The imp has despoiled it, but perhaps this child can restore the name to honor, if the bastard lives so long. I know you are not to blame. Lady Tanda is the sister that I never had, and you, her voice broke, forgive me. I live in fear. Felice opened and closed her mouth, which made her look like some especially stupid fish. In fear, Your Grace. I have not slept a whole night through since Joffrey died. Circe filled the goblets with hippocras. My friends, you are my friends, I hope, and King Tommen's. That sweet lad, Sir Balmain declared. Your Grace, the very words of House Stokeworth are proud to be faithful. Would that there were more like you, good sir. I tell you truly, I have grave doubts about Sir Bronn of the Blackwater. Husband and wife exchanged a look. The man is insolent, Your Grace, Felice said, uncouth and foul-mouthed. He is no true knight, Sir Balmain said. No, Circe smiled, all for him, and you are a man who would know true knighthood. I remember watching you joust in... Which tourney was it where you fought so brilliantly, sir? He smiled modestly. That affair at Duskendale, 6 years ago? No, you were not there, else you would surely have been crowned the Queen of Love and Beauty. Was it the tourney at Lannisport, after Greyjoy's rebellion? I unhorsed many a good knight in that one. That was the one. Her face grew somber. The imp vanished the night my father died, leaving two honest jailers behind in pools of blood. Some claim he fled across the narrow sea, but I wonder. The dwarf is cunning. Perhaps he still lurks near, planning more murders. Perhaps some friend is hiding him. Bronn, Sir Balmain stroked his bushy moustache. He was ever the imp's creature. Only the stranger knows how many men he sent to hell at Tyrion's behest. Your Grace, I think I should have noticed a dwarf skulking about our lands, said Sir Balmain. My brother is small. He was made for skulking. Circe let her hand shake. A child's name is a small thing, but insolence unpunished breeds rebellion, and this man Bronn has been gathering sellswords to him, Qyburn has told me. He has taken four knights into his household, said Felice. Sir Balmain snorted. My good wife flatters them to call them knights. They're up-jumped sellswords, with not a thimble of chivalry to be found amongst the four of them. As I feared, Bronn is gathering swords for the dwarf. May the seven save my little son. The imp will kill him as he killed his brother. She sobbed. My friends, I put my honor in your hands, but what is a queen's honor against a mother's fears? Say on, Your Grace, Sir Balmain assured her. Your words shall ne'er leave this room. Circe reached across the table and gave his hand a squeeze. I would sleep more easily of a night if I were to hear that Sir Bronn had suffered a mishap? Whilst hunting, perhaps. Sir Balmain considered a moment. A mortal mishap? No, I desire you to break his little toe. She had to bite her lip. My enemies are everywhere, and my friends are fools. I beg you, sir, she whispered, do not make me say it. I understand. Sir Balmain raised a finger. A turnip would have grasped it quicker. You are a true knight indeed, sir. The answer to a frightened mother's prayers. Circe kissed him. Do it quickly, if you would. Bronn has only a few men about him now, but if we do not act, he will surely gather more. She kissed Felice. I shall never forget this, my friends, my true friends of Stokeworth, proud to be faithful. You have my word. We shall find Lollys a better husband when this is done. A kettle black, perhaps. We Lannisters pay our debts. The rest was hippocras and buttered beets, hot-baked bread, herb-crusted pike, and ribs of wild boar. Circe had become very fond of boar since Robert's death. She did not even mind the company, though Felice simpered and Balmain preened from soup to sweet. It was past midnight before she could rid herself of them. Sir Balmain proved a great one for suggesting yet another flagon, and the Queen did not think it prudent to refuse. I could have hired a faceless man to kill Bronn for half of what I've spent on Hippocras, she reflected, when they were gone at last. At that hour her son was fast asleep, but Circe looked in upon him before seeking her own bed. She was surprised to find three black kittens cuddled up beside him. Where did those come from? She asked Sir Merin Trant, outside the royal bedchamber. The little queen gave them to him. She only meant to give him one, but he couldn't decide which one he liked the best. Better than cutting them out of their mother with a dagger, I suppose. Marjorie's clumsy attempts at seduction were so obvious as to be laughable. Tommen is too young for kisses, so she gives him kittens. Circe rather wished they were not black, though. Black cats brought ill luck, as Rhaegar's little girl had discovered in this very castle. She would have been my daughter, if the Mad King had not played his cruel jape on father. It had to have been the madness that led Ares to refuse Lord Tywin's daughter and take his son instead, whilst marrying his own son to a feeble Dornish princess with black eyes and a flat chest. The memory of the rejection still rankled, even after all these years. Many a night she had watched Prince Rhaegar in the hall, playing his silver-stringed harp with those long, elegant fingers of his. Had any man ever been so beautiful? He was more than a man, though. His blood was the blood of old Valyria, the blood of dragons and gods. When she was just a little girl, her father had promised her that she would marry Rhaegar. She could not have been more than 6 or 7. Never speak of it, child, he had told her, smiling his secret smile that only Circe ever saw. Not until his grace agrees to the betrothal. It must remain our secret for now. And so it had, though once she had drawn a picture of herself flying behind Rhaegar on a dragon, her arms wrapped tight about his chest. When Jaime had discovered it, she told him it was Queen Alysanne and King Jaehaerys. She was 10 when she finally saw her prince in the flesh at the tourney her lord father had thrown to welcome King Aerys to the west. Viewing stands had been raised beneath the walls of Lannisport, and the cheers of the small folk had echoed off Casterly Rock like rolling thunder. They cheered father twice as loudly as they cheered the king, the queen recalled, but only half as loudly as they cheered Prince Rhaegar. 17, and new to knighthood, Rhaegar Targaryen had worn black plate over golden ringmail when he cantered onto the lists. Long streamers of red and gold and orange silk had floated behind his helm, like flames. Two of her uncles fell before his lance, along with a dozen of her father's finest jousters, the flower of the West. By night the prince played his silver harp and made her weep. When she had been presented to him, Circe had almost drowned in the depths of his sad purple eyes. "He has been wounded," she recalled, thinking, "but I will mend his hurt when we are wed." Next to Rhaegar, even her beautiful Jaime had seemed no more than a callow boy. "The prince is going to be my husband," she had thought, giddy with excitement, "and when the old king dies, I'll be the queen." Her aunt had confided that truth to her before the tourney. "You must be especially beautiful," Lady Jenna told her, fussing with her dress, "for at the final feast it shall be announced that you and Prince Rhaegar are betrothed." Circe had been so happy that day. Elsewise she would never have dared visit the tent of Maggie the Frog. She had only done it to show Jane and Melara that the lioness fears nothing. "I was going to be a queen. Why should a queen be afraid of some hideous old woman?" The memory of that foretelling still made her flesh crawl a lifetime later. Jane ran shrieking from the tent in fear, the queen remembered, "but Melara stayed, and so did I. We let her taste our blood and laugh at her stupid prophecies. None of them made the least bit of sense." She was going to be Prince Rhaegar's wife, no matter what the woman said. Her father had promised it, and Tywin Lannister's word was gold. Her laughter died at tourney's end. There had been no final feast, no toasts to celebrate her betrothal to Prince Rhaegar, only cold silences and chilly looks between the king and her father. Later, when Ares and his son and all his gallant knights had departed for King's Landing, the girl had gone to her aunt in tears, not understanding. "Your father proposed the match," Lady Jenna told her, but Ares refused to hear of it. "You are my most able servant, Tywin," the king said, "but a man does not marry his heir to his servant's daughter. Dry those tears, little one. Have you ever seen a lion weep? Your father will find another man for you, a better man than Rhaegar." Her aunt had lied, though, and her father had failed her, just as Jaime was failing her now. Father found no better man. Instead, he gave me Robert, and Maggie's curse bloomed like some poisonous flower. If she had only married Rhaegar as the gods intended, he would never have looked twice at the wolf girl. Rhaegar would be our king today, and I would be his queen, the mother of his sons. She had never forgiven Robert for killing him. But then, lions were not good at forgiving, as Ser Bronn of the Blackwater would shortly learn.
The Lost Lord. "It shouldn't have taken this long," Griff told himself as he paced the deck of the Shy Maid. Had they lost Holden, as they had Tyrion Lannister? Could the Volantines have taken him? I should have sent Dutfield with him. Holden alone could not be trusted. He had proved that in Sel Horis when he let the dwarf escape. The Shy Maid was tied up in one of the meaner sections of the long, chaotic riverfront, between a listing pole boat that had not left the pier in years and the gaily painted Mummer's Barge. The Mummers were a loud and lively lot, always quoting speeches at each other, and drunk more off than not. The day was hot and sticky, as all the days had been since they left the Sorrows. A ferocious southern sun beat down upon the crowded riverfront of Volantheris. But heat was the last and least of Griff's concerns. The Golden Company was encamped 3 miles south of town, well north of where he had expected them, and Triarch Malaquo had come north with 5,000 foot and 1,000 horse to cut them off from the Delta Road. Daenerys Targaryen remained a world away, and Tyrion Lannister, well, he could be most anywhere. If the guards were good, Lannister's severed head was halfway back to King's Landing by now, but more like the dwarf was hale and whole and somewhere close, stinking drunk, and plotting some new infamy. "Where in the Seven Hells is Holden?" Griff complained to Lady Lamore. "How long should it take to buy 3 horses? She shrugged. "My lord, wouldn't it be safer to leave the boy here aboard the boat?" "Safer, yes. Wiser, no. He is a man grown now, and this is the road that he was born to walk." Griff had no patience for this quibbling. He was sick of hiding, sick of waiting, sick of caution. "I do not have time enough for caution. We have gone to great lengths to keep Prince Aegon hidden all these years," Lamore reminded him. "The time will come for him to wash his hair and declare himself. I know, but that time is not now, not to a camp of sellswords. If Harry Strickland means him ill, hiding on the Shy Maid will not protect him. Strickland has 10,000 swords at his command. We have Doc. Aegon is all that could be wanted in a prince. They need to see that, Strickland and the rest. These are his own men. His because they're bought and paid for. 10,000 armed strangers plus hangers-on and camp followers. All it takes is one to bring us all to ruin. If Hugo's head was worth a lord's honours, how much will Cersei Lannister pay for the rightful heir to the Iron Throne? You do not know these men, my lord. It has been 12 years since you last rode with the Golden Company, and your old friend is dead."
Blackheart. Mars Twain had been so full of life the last time Griff had left him. It was hard to accept that he was gone. a golden skull atop a pole, and homeless Harry Strickland in his place. Limor was not wrong, he knew. Whatever their sires or their grandsires might have been back in Westeros before their exile, the men of the Golden Company were sellswords now, and no sellsword could be trusted. Even so. Last night he dreamt of Stony Septian. Alone with sword in hand, he ran from house to house, smashing down doors, racing upstairs, leaping from roof to roof as his ears rang to the sound of distant bells. Deep bronze booms and silver chiming pounded through his skull, a maddening cacophony of noise that grew ever louder until it seemed as if his head would explode. 17 years had come and gone since the Battle of the Bells, yet the sound of bells ringing still tied a knot in his guts. Others might claim that the realm was lost when Prince Rhaegar fell to Robert's Warhammer on the Trident. But the Battle of the Trident would never have been fought if the Griffin had only slain the stag there in Stony Sept. The bells tolled for all of us that day, for Aerys and his queen, for Elia of Dorne and her little daughter, for every true man and honest woman in the Seven Kingdoms, and for my silver prince. The plan was to reveal Prince Aegon only when we reached Queen Daenerys, L'Amour was saying. That was when we believed the girl was coming west. Our dragon queen has burned that plan to ash, and thanks to that fat fool in Pentos, we have grasped the she-dragon by the tail and burned our fingers to the bone. Illyrio could not have been expected to know that the girl would choose to remain a Slaver's Bay. No more than he knew that the Beggar King would die young, or that Khal Drogo would follow him into the grave. Very little of what the fat man has anticipated has come to pass. Griff slapped the hilt of his longsword with a gloved hand. I've danced to the fat man's pipes for years, L'Amour. What has it availed us? The prince is a man grown. His time is... Griff! Yandri called loudly above the clanging of the mummer's bell. It's Alden! So it was. The half-maester looked hot and bedraggled as he made his way along the waterfront to the foot of the pier. Sweat had left dark rings beneath the arms of his light linen robes, and he had the same sour look on his long face as at Salori's when he returned to the Shy Maid to confess that the dwarf was gone. He was leading 3 horses, however, and that was all that mattered. "Bring the boy," Griff told L'Amour. "See that he's ready." "As you say," she answered unhappily. "So be it." He'd grown fond of L'Amour, but that did not mean he required her approval. Her task had been to instruct the prince in the doctrines of the faith, and she had done that. No amount of prayer would put him on the Iron Throne, however. That was Griff's task. He had failed Prince Rhaegar once. He would not fail his son, not whilst life remained in his body. Holden's horses did not please him. "Were these the best that you could find?" he complained to the half-maester. "They were," said Holden, in an irritated tone. "And you had best not ask what they cost us. With Dothraki across the river, half the populace of Volunteers has decided they will sooner be elsewhere. So horse flesh grows more expensive every day." "I should have gone myself." After Selhoris, he had found it difficult to put the same trust in Holden as previously. He let the dwarf beguile him with that glib tongue of his, let him wander off into a whorehouse alone, while he lingered like a moon calf in the square. The brothel keeper had insisted that the little man had been carried off at sword point, but Griff was still not sure he believed that. The imp was clever enough to have conspired in his own escape. This drunken captor that the whore spoke of could have been some henchman in his hire. I share the blame. After the dwarf put himself between Aegon and the stone man, I let down my guard.
I should have slit his throat the first time I laid eyes on him. They will do well enough, I suppose, he told Alden. The camp is only 3 miles south. The Shymaid would have gotten them there more quickly, but he preferred to keep Harry Strickland ignorant of where he and the prince had been. Nor did he relish the prospect of splashing through the shallows to climb some muddy riverbank. That sort of entrance might serve for a sellsword and his son, but not for a great lord and his prince. When the lad emerged from the cabin with L'Amour by his side, Griff looked him over carefully from head to heel. The prince wore sword and dagger, black boots polished to a high sheen, a black cloak lined with blood-red silk. With his hair washed and cut and freshly dyed a deep dark blue, his eyes looked blue as well. At his throat he wore 3 huge, square-cut rubies on a chain of black iron, a gift for Magister Illyrio. Red and black dragon colours, that was good. "You look a proper prince," he told the boy. "Your father would be proud if he could see you." Young Griff ran his fingers through his hair. "I'm sick of this blue dye. We should have washed it out."
"Soon enough." Griff would be glad to go back to his own true colours, too, though his once red hair had gone to grey. He clapped the lad on the shoulder. "Shall we go? Your army awaits your coming."
"I like the sound of that. My army?" A smile flashed across his face, then vanished. "Are they, though? They're sellswords. Yolo warned me to trust no one."
"There is wisdom in that," Griff admitted. "It might have been different if Blackheart still commanded. But Miles Toyne was 4 years dead, and homeless Harry Strickland was a different sort of man. He would not say that to the boy, however. That dwarf had already planted enough doubts in his young head. Not every man is what he seems, and a prince especially has good cause to be wary. But go too far down that road, and the mistrust can poison you, make you sour and fearful. King Ares was one such. By the end, even Rhaegar saw that plain enough. You would do best to walk a middle course. Let men earn your trust with leal service, but when they do, be generous and open-hearted." The boy nodded. "I will remember." They gave the prince the best of the 3 horses, a big grey gelding so pale that he was almost white. Griff and Holden rode beside him on lesser mounts. The road ran south, beneath the high white walls of Volunteers, for a good 30 miles. Then they left the town behind, following the winding course of the Roine through willow groves and poppy fields and past a tall wooden windmill, whose blades creaked like old bones as they turned. They found the Golden Company beside the river as the sun was lowering in the west. It was a camp that even Arthur Dayne might have approved of, compact, orderly, defensible. A deep ditch had been dug around it, with sharp stakes inside. The tents stood in rows with broad avenues between them. The latrines had been placed beside the river, so the current could wash away the wastes. The horse lines were to the north, and beyond them 2 dozen elephants grazed beside the water, pulling up reeds with their trunks. Griff glanced at the great grey beasts with approval. "There is not a war horse in all of Westeros that will stand against them." Tall battle standards of cloth of gold flapped atop lofty poles along the perimeters of the camp. Beneath them, armed and armoured sentries walked their rounds with spears and crossbows, watching every approach. Griff had feared that the company might have grown lax under Harry Strickland, who had always seemed more concerned with making friends than enforcing discipline. But it would seem his worries had been misplaced. At the gate, Holden said something to the sergeant of guards, and a runner was sent off to find a captain. When he turned up, he was just as ugly as the last time Griff laid eyes on him. A big-bellied, shambling hulk of a man. The sellsword had a seamed face, crisscrossed with old scars. His right ear looked as if a dog had chewed on it, and his left was missing. "Have they made you a captain, Flowers?" Griff said. "I thought the Golden Company had standards."
"It's worse than that, you bugger," said Franklin Flowers. "They knighted me as well."
He clasped Griff by the forearm, pulled him into a bone-crushing hug.
"You look awful, even for a man's been dead a dozen years. Blue hair, is it? When Harry said you'd be turning up, I almost shit myself. And Alden, you icy cunt, good to see you too. Still have that stick up your arse?"
He turned to young Griff. "And this would be, my squire. Lad, this is Franklin Flowers." The prince acknowledged him with a nod.
"Flowers is a bastard name. You're from the rich."
"Aye, my mother was a washerwoman at Cider Hall, till one of my lord's sons raped her. Makes me a sort of brown apple fuss away, the way I see it."
Flowers waved them through the gate.
"Come with me. Strickland's called all the officers to his tent. War council. The bloody Volunteers are rattling their spears and demanding to know our intentions."
The men of the Golden Company were outside their tents, dicing, drinking, and swatting away flies. Griff wondered how many of them knew who he was. Few enough. 12 years is a long time. Even the men who'd ridden with him might not recognize the exiled Lord Conington, of the fiery red beard, in the lined, clean-shaven face and dyed blue hair of the sellsword Griff. So far as most of them were concerned, Conington had drunk himself to death in Lice, after being driven from the company in disgrace for stealing from the war chest. The shame of the lie still stuck in his craw, but Varys had insisted it was necessary.
"We want no songs about regallant exile," the eunuch had tittered in that mincing voice of his. "Those who die heroic deaths are long remembered, thieves and drunks and cravens soon forgotten."
"What does a eunuch know of a man's honour?" Griff had gone along with the spider scheme for the boy's sake, but that did not mean he liked it any better. "Let me live long enough to see the boy sit the Iron Throne, and Varys will pay for that slight, and so much more. Then we'll see who's soon forgotten." The Captain General's tent was made of cloth of gold and surrounded by a ring of pikes, topped with gilded skulls. One skull was larger than the rest, grotesquely malformed. Below it was a second, no larger than a child's fist. "Meles, the monstrous, and his nameless brother." The other skulls had a sameness to them, though several had been cracked and splintered by the blows that had slain them, and one had filed, pointed teeth. "Which one is Miles?" Griff found himself asking.
"There, on the end," Flowers pointed. "Wait, I'll go announce you."
He slipped inside the tent, leaving Griff to contemplate the gilded skull of his old friend. In life, Sir Miles Toyne had been ugly as sin. His famous forebear, the dark and dashing Terence Toyne, of whom the singers sang, had been so fair of face that even the king's mistress could not resist him. But Miles had been possessed of jug ears, a crooked jaw, and the biggest nose that John Cunnington had ever seen. When he smiled at you, though, none of that mattered. Blackheart, his men had named him, for the sigil on his shield. Miles had loved the name and all it hinted at.
"A captain general should be feared by friend and foe alike," he had once confessed. "If men think me cruel, so much the better."
The truth was otherwise. Soldier to the bone, Toyne was fierce but always fair, a father to his men and always generous to the exiled Lord John Conington. Death had robbed him of his ears, his nose, and all his warmth. The smile remained, transformed into a glittering golden grin. All the skulls were grinning, even bitter steels on the tall pike in the centre.
"What does he have to grin about? He died defeated and alone, a broken man, in an alien land."
On his deathbed,
Sir Aegor Rivers had famously commanded his men to boil the flesh from his skull, dip it in gold, and carry it before them when they crossed the sea to retake Westeros. His successors had followed his example. John Connington might have been one of those successors if his exile had gone otherwise. He had spent 5 years with the company, rising from the ranks to a place of honour at Toyne's right hand. Had he stayed, it might well have been him the men turned to after Miles died instead of Harry Strickland. But Griff did not regret the path he'd chosen. "When I return to Westeros, it will not be as a skull atop a pole." Flower stepped out the tent. "Go on in." The high officers of the Golden Company rose from stools and camp chairs as they entered. Old friends greeted Griff with smiles and embraces, the new men more formally. "Not all of them are as glad to see us as they would have me believe." He sensed knives behind some of the smiles. Until quite recently, most of them had believed that Lord John Connington was safely in his grave, and no doubt many felt that was a fine place for him, a man who would steal from his brothers in arms. Griff might have felt the same way in their place. Sir Franklin did the introductions. Some of the sellsword captains bore bastard names, as Flowers did. Rivers, Hill, Stone. Others claimed names that had once loomed large in the histories of the Seven Kingdoms. Griff counted two Strongs, three Peaks, a Mud, a Mandrake, a Lowston, a pair of Coals. Not all were genuine, he knew. In the free companies, a man could call himself whatever he chose. By any name, the sellswords displayed a rude splendour. Like many in their trade, they kept their worldly wealth upon their person, jewel swords, inlaid armour, heavy torques, and fine silks were much in evidence, and every man there wore a lord's ransom in golden armrings. Each ring signified 1 year's service with the Golden Company. Mark Mandrake, whose puck-scarred face had a hole in one cheek where a slave's mark had been burned away, wore a chain of golden skulls as well. Not every captain was of Westerosi blood. Black Balak, a white-haired summer islander with skin dark as soot, commanded the company's archers, as in Blackheart's day. He wore a feather cloak of green and orange, magnificent to behold. The cadaverous volantine, Goris Edorian, had replaced Strickland as paymaster. A leopard skin was draped across one shoulder, and hair as red as blood tumbled to his shoulders in oiled ringlets, though his pointed beard was black. The spymaster was new to Griff, a Lyseni named Lysino Maur, with lilac eyes and white gold hair and lips that would have been the envy of a whore. At first glance, Griff had almost taken him for a woman. His fingernails were painted purple, and his earlobes dripped with pearls and amethysts. "Ghosts and liars," Griff thought, as he surveyed their faces. "Revenants from forgotten wars, lost causes, failed rebellions, a brotherhood of the failed and the fallen, the disgraced and disinherited. This is my army. This is our best hope." He turned to Harry Strickland. Homeless Harry looked little like a warrior, portly, with a big round head, mild grey eyes, and thinning hair that he brushed sideways to conceal a bald spot. Strickland sat in a camp chair, soaking his feet in a tub of salt water. "You will pardon me if I do not rise," he said, by way of greeting. "Our march was wearisome, and my toes are prone to blisters. It's a curse."
"It is a mark of weakness. You sound like an old woman."
The Stricklands had been part of the Golden Company since its founding. Harry's great-grandsire, having lost his lands when he rose with a black dragon during the first Blackfyre Rebellion. "Gold for 4 generations, Harry would boast, as if 4 generations of exile and defeat were something to take pride in. "I can make you an ointment for that," said Holden, "and there are certain mineral salts that will toughen your skin." "That is kind of you," Strickland beckoned to his squire.
Watkin, wine for our friends. Thank you, but no, said Griff. We will drink water. As you prefer. The Captain General smiled up at the prince. And this must be your son. Does he know?